That brings me to what many people think of first when they think of the clash between Torah and science. And that is the age of the universe, which includes within it disputes about dinosaurs, disputes about evolution. But the fundamental question is, how old is the rock that we're standing on? Right? That's the fundamental question. And how old is the universe that it inhabits? According to the Torah, how old is our world?
5, 7, 7, and 6 days.
Right. 5, 7, 7, 7, and 6 days, Diane says. The right. That's our count. How do we get that number? Besides the calendar you get sent in the mail from whatever orphanage you donated to? Where does that number come from?
It's interesting. Where?
No? Okay. The answer is, sorry.
Is it an arbitrary number?
Oh, no. Definitely not arbitrary.
No, no.
It's not counting.
Counting the?
Well, 6 days is a creation.
Not quite.
Genesis is 6 days.
Right. We have 6 days of creation, and then we start counting from the creation of humanity on day six. But the answer is that it's actually relatively straightforward. You start with the big S. Right? Meaning Adam was this old when Seth was born, and then Seth was this old when Enosh was born, and so on down to Noah, all the way down to Abraham. We know the ages of each of our patriarchs when they had their children. Sometimes you know with the matriarchs as well. So we just count that up. We know the ages in terms of our stay in Egypt, because, for example, we know that Moshe's mother, Yocheved, is 130 years old when he is born. How we know it is a good discussion, but Moshe's mother is 130 when he's born, and he's 80 years old when he goes to the Pharaoh. And then you know you have 40 years in the wilderness, and you know that 440 years after they enter Israel is when they build the first temple. You can count up the number of the years of the kings and so forth, and that will almost get you where you need to go. Almost, because Tanakh ends with the construction of the second temple. So therefore you have to now go based on historical records from the destruction from the construction of the second temple all the way through. That's number one. And number two, because there's a little problem of a missing 165 years or so at the beginning of the Second Temple period. Without belaboring things and getting way far afield, the accounts that we have biblically of the Persian kings don't match the secular accounts of the Persian kings who correspond with the construction of the Second Temple. The king who allows us to build the Second Temple is Cyrus. And that we know. We have his documents. Once you get into this period of history, you have so much material, you don't know what to do with it. So we know very well when Cyrus lived. And that's our problem. Because if you go by the classic count, he should have lived 165 years later than he did. That's essentially, there's more to be said about it. We have too few Persian kings in our count, but the bottom line is that the way we would get to our age of 5,777 years is simply by counting up all the people, generation after generation in the Torah, using the numbers in Tanakh, and then once you get to the Second Temple, you have historical records to work with. No one disagrees, for example, except for, almost no one disagrees that the Second Temple was destroyed in the year 68 or 70. The only ones who disagree are the people who think that we never had a temple in Jerusalem, before. But you can throw them in with the people who disagree with Copernicus, because no, the world goes around the sun. The general chronology is okay in that sense. There is also the idea, which I brought you in source number 8, of a 6,000 year period for the world. Passage in the Talmud, Rav Katina said, yes, if you're starting to get worried, the world will exist for 6,000 years and then be desolate for 1,000. Where did you get that idea from? A verse in Isaiah. And God will stand alone on that day. What in the world does that have to do with 6,000 and 1,000? It's true, there is a verse. V'nisgav Hashem levado b'yom ahu. God will stand alone on that day. So what? How do we get that? You're right, but how do we get that? There's a verse in Tehillim, in Psalms, which says that a day is, that 1,000 years are like a day in God's eyes. Ki elef shanim be'enecha ki yom etmol. For 1,000 years in your eyes are like one day. That's the idea. That's actually going to matter a great deal later on, but we're not going to get to why that matters this week. But the principle is that 1,000 years in God's eyes is like a day. And so when the verse says God will stand alone on that day, well, if he's alone, it's about his perception. So I guess that means there will be a day, 1,000 years, when God is alone. That doesn't say it's going to be after 6,000. So hang on to the question of why it should be after 6,000 years. Maybe it's after 1,000,000 years. Who knows? Abaye, another sage, said it will be desolate for 2,000. He quotes you a verse in Hosea. This verse is such a problematic verse for a completely different reason. Look at this one. Hosea is a prophet towards the end of the first temple period. And he says, he, God, will revive us after 2 days. On the third day, he will raise us up and we will live before him. Why does this verse give us big problems with some of our neighbors? Yeah, doesn't it? They love this line. See that? On the third day, he will raise us up. You should all go celebrate Easter now. No. That's not what it meant. It's very easy to invent legends when you have scripture in front of you and you just, you know, borrow it and then say, oh, look, it says it over here. But in any case, Abaye says two days. So that's 2,000 years that the world is desolate. And then after that, we come back to life. We have learned in support of Rav Kitina that it's 1,000. Just as a sabbatical year releases 1 year every 7, so the world will release 1,000 years every 7,000 years. In other words, we have a mitzvah of Shemitah, leaving the land in Israel fallow 1 year out of every 7. Just like we have a mitzvah of Shabbat, right? That you have 1 day of rest every 7. You also have Yovel, the Jubilee, which is every 7 cycles of the 7 years. So this is a bigger idea that after 6,000 years, 1,000 years of Shemitah for the world gets a rest. Every 6,000 years, there will then be a break of 1,000 years. Well, we take all of that and say, astrophysics has an issue with you. Take a look at source number 9 from NASA's website, How Old is the Universe? Until recently, astronomers estimated that the Big Bang occurred between 12 and 14 billion years ago. To put this in perspective, the solar system is thought to be 4.5 billion years old. Humans have existed as a genus for only a few million years. Astronomers estimate the age of the universe in two ways. One, by looking for the oldest stars. Two, by measuring the rate of expansion of the universe and extrapolating back to the Big Bang. Just as crime detectives can trace the origin of a bullet from the holes in a wall, right? You have two methods. Either you look for the oldest stars, and then you ask, well, how old are they? And that gives me the minimum age of the universe, because a star hopefully is not going to be older than the universe itself. You can't be older than your mother. Or, alternatively, you look at how it is expanding, you look at the rate of speed, and you say, well, at some point there was a Big Bang and it was all together. How long did it take to get from being all together to where it is now? The reason why the numbers aren't quite clear is because the rate of expansion may change depending on how much mass there is in the universe. So when scientists disagree about how much mass there is in the universe, they will also disagree about possible changes in the speed at which things are expanding and therefore the calculation of how long it's been traveling, so to speak. Clear? Hopefully. I mean, whatever, that's a lot. Okay. But these two methods actually matter. They point out there's a little bit of a crisis in this, and that's why they said until recently. I like this point too much to just pass it by. If we compare the two age determinations, there's a potential crisis. If the universe is flat and dominated by ordinary or dark matter, the age of the universe, as inferred from the Hubble constant, that's the rate of expansion that I was talking about, would be about 9 billion years. And the problem is the age of the universe would be shorter than the age of oldest stars. You'd have stars that are older than the universe. You can't do that. That's not allowed. So this contradiction implies that either our measure of the Hubble constant is incorrect, or the Big Bang theory is incorrect, or that we need a form of matter like a cosmological constant that implies an older age for a given observed expansion rate. The cosmological constant is what's known, going back to high school lab, as a fudge factor. Remember the phrase? The fudge factor is what you use in lab when your numbers don't work, but if you just magically multiply them by a number you invented, then everything comes out the way it's supposed to. Einstein invents it first. He does not like it, but he says, this is the only way I can make things, you know, fit. Then they think it's not necessary, and now it's come back into vogue. This is the in a bit of a different way, but this is what's being referred to here in number three, that there must be some way to account for everything and make the numbers work, such as by adjusting the estimate of the mass of the universe. Okay. And then they say some believe the crisis will pass as soon as measurements improve, and so on. The bottom line is that I don't care what you do with the cosmological constant and how you resolve the problem of stars that are older than the universe. The fundamental issue is no one is anywhere near 6,000. I mean, not even like remotely close. So what do we do with Rosh Hashanah? What do we do with Rosh Hashanah? You know, when I was in my smicha classes, training for ordination at Yeshiva University, so one of the classes we had to take was homiletics. It was a speaking class. And the teacher was Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, who you may have seen in the news from time to time. So so one of the things that he had some of the guys do was he wanted them to get up and give a model Rosh Hashanah drasha, model Rosh Hashanah sermon. And I'll never forget, this one guy gets up there, and he's actually Canadian, and he starts off his speech by saying, tonight, 5,700 and whatever it was, you know, years ago, the world was created. But no one really believes that. That was his opening for his model Rosh Hashanah drasha. Let me tell you, he had everybody's attention. He had everybody's attention. But the question is, fundamentally, what do we do? What are our options for dealing with this crisis? What would you say?
Well, we fudged it, you said that.
Yeah, but how far? I mean, 165 years is nothing here. You're talking millions. Where are the millions? Let alone the dinosaurs.
In the 6 days.
Mm-hmm. Right. So Linda floats the idea that we're talking about the history of humanity.
Yeah.
However, even if you work with the history of humanity, they have us be existing as a genus for what was it? Only a few million years. Right? At what point was that genus developed, and what's the relationship between it and Adam? And the Torah doesn't depict Adam against a backdrop of others who are around. It's not as though you could say, well, Adam was the first human being with whom God spoke, but there were others who had come out of the Neanderthal era or whatever it was. Or maybe no, Adam is the first one who's no longer a Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, whatever point you want to put it, because we don't get a description of anybody else around. This is creation, day one, or day six, fine. But it's the beginning. So this is a very hard idea to work with. Mordechai, you were going to say?
Well, I think we have to adopt the view that the story of creation isn't meant to be literal. It's an entry way to all sorts of
So another approach might be to say it's an allegory. It wasn't meant as a literal read. That's a second approach, right? These are going back to the approaches that we outlined in week one of what you do when you have a problem, right? So one approach was to say it doesn't matter. Torah is right, science is wrong, and that's the end of my conversation. Another approach is to say, let's see if we can figure out a way for Torah to fit the data. And that would fit, be along the lines of what Linda is saying about maybe the Torah is the story of humanity. Another approach is to reinterpret Torah entirely and say, I didn't understand Torah. That wasn't what it was trying to say. Yeah?
Question. In the beginning, there was like total chaos. So what was... There was something that was chaos. How long was
right.
it like that?
Right. So another way to look at it is to say, and this is part of the reinterpretation, but I think it's deeper than the reinterpretation idea, is to say, when I read the account of the Torah, it's possible to fit in the millions into certain points that are found within the text, like the second verse of the Torah says, V'haaretz hayta tohu vavohu, the world was tohu and bohu. No one really knows how to translate the words tohu vavohu. We get all sorts of nice attempts. Tohu generally is emptiness, And bohu is something that goes along with emptiness. That's more or less the way that we work with it. But maybe you can suggest that that was going on for a very long time. It won't solve the Adam problem. Adam, A-D-A-M. It won't solve that problem. But it will give the universe a longer history before Adam. Possibly. That will be an approach. I want to also note, Stephen, I heard say that the 6 days don't have to be 6 days. Right? We've already opened up the possibility of saying that it's 6,000, that 1,000 years is a day. You also know that it's likely that the 6 days are not 24-hour days. How do you know that? The sun and the moon. What do you mean? You're right. Yeah. 24-hour days are based on the Earth and its rotation, right? And its exposure to the sun. There is no sun until day four. When God says, let there be light on day one, he doesn't mean sunlight. So therefore, there's no reason to think that it's a 24-hour day. Except for one point. How does the Torah describe the cycle of the first days? Vayi erev, vayi boker. It was evening and it was morning. Which makes it sound like it's, you know, a 24-hour day. The truth of the matter is, this was entertained long before anyone had a problem with the age of the universe. Meaning, the early commentators on the biblical text asked the question of, why would these be 24-hour days? Why is the Earth rotating at all? The whole idea of it, you know, when you don't have gravitational, they weren't talking about gravitational influences, but they're talking about it in general, in terms of the functioning of the Earth in that period of time, certainly the first 3 days, there's really no reason to think it had to be 24 hours, but then they all, not all of them, most of them say, yeah, but nonetheless, just assume it's 24 hours, because that's neater than trying to figure out what it might have been. Yes, Marlene?
I don't know. Could we be counting from the time that Adam and Eve became aware of knowledge and you know, the Garden of Eden being expelled from the Garden of Eden? Could that be the time to count?
Could be. But what do you do with the creation of Adam and Eve? Yeah. The whole story about creating Adam from the dirt, right? According to you, there should be, you know, parents. Eve had in-laws. Or parents, actually, if she's made from Adam, right? Like they're her parents, too. She's a clone. What does that create problems? So, psychological, if nothing else. So, we have a fundamental problem, Shauna.
Maybe, like, sometimes we say that there are things in the Torah that we just don't understand that are beyond us. So maybe this is
one
of them. Maybe this whole timeline thing is just something that we as people can't get our heads around exactly, to know exactly.
Right. And along the lines of what Mordechai had said of just explaining that whole story allegorically, that's an approach. That's an approach that some will take. I mean, the idea of saying, you know, sort of just, let me block that off and deal with the rest of Torah, works for some people, and others look at it and say, well, frankly, I come away feeling like this is just, you know, the primitive myth of a self-important people who wanted to position themselves at the center, and to say that God created their ancestor way back when, on this tiny planet in a very large universe, right? If you think of Carl Sagan, you know, talking about the billions and billions of stars, you know, and how we are insignificant, and these are just myths that people create in order to, you know, defend against that fear that we're nothing. Telling somebody, just ignore that part of Torah, is a challenge. You know, particularly when we live in an age which is the exact opposite of that approach. Science won in the sense that the scientific method now dominates the way we work. We observe data, we come up with theories, and then we shoot holes in the theory until we come up with a theory that explains the world in front of us. But fundamentally, we are intellectual beings, and that is the way we work. Certainly, if you go to university, if you do anything in terms of education, that's the way you're taught to teach, critical thinking. So, one of the approaches is to say, Breshit is not literal. One of the approaches is to say that Breshit is not to be taken literally. If you take a look at source number 10, you see perhaps the best source for this. We're going to start on it now, we'll have to come back to it next time. But this is from Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed. He says, Keep in mind, of course, that he has no issues with the age of the universe. No one is talking about billion years and whatever in the 12th century. He says he's dealing with a different debate. Let me actually give it background. In his time, one of the major debates going back to the Greeks is whether the world was created or it always existed. Jews believed, based on the Torah, that it was created. There were among the Greeks those who said, absolutely not. The world has always been here. Kadmut ha'olam is the phrase in Hebrew. So he says, know that our flight from the idea of a, quote, first, meaning non-created universe, the idea that it was always there, our rejection of that idea is not because of the Torah's verses which speak of a created world. The texts which teach creation of the world are no greater than the texts which teach that God is physical. And the gates of interpretation are not sealed before us. They are not withheld from us regarding creation of the universe. In other words, what he's trying to say is, there are an awful lot of verses that speak about God as having a physical form. Can you give me an example? The hand of God was outstretched upon, fill in the blank, enemy of the, you know, enemy of the day. Right? God's mighty hand. Well, if God doesn't have a body, then how does he have a hand?
God saw that it was good.
God saw, implying that he has eyes. Right? All sorts of verses that seem to suggest that God has some element of physicality. Forget the conversation about God's moods. God getting angry, God regretting. We're made in the image of God, right? All sorts of problematic verses. Maimonides says, yeah, we took care of those. Because I don't believe that God is physical philosophically. Among other things, if God would be physical, that would mean he would be subject to deterioration. All things that are physical, he takes as a given, deteriorate. And all things that are physical are divisible. You can break them down into parts. He says, that can't be about God. God is one. So therefore, it must mean that God is not physical. And in terms of all those verses, I explain them differently. God's mighty hand means God's strength is on display. That's all it means. The image of God means the image designated by God for human beings. We come up with all different ways to explain those verses so that we can retain our philosophical idea that God is not physical. He says, I can do the same thing with the verses that indicate that the world was created. Even though it says, Breshit bara Elokim, Teshamayim v'et ha'aretz, the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth, he says, yeah, I could deal with that. We could explain them as we did in distancing the idea of physicality. And it may even be much easier. Ha! And further, we could explain those texts to support that the universe was first, meaning that the universe was not created. As we have explained texts to distance the physicality of God. In other words, I'll go even further. Not only can I rationalize these verses and make them fit with a world that always existed, I can even make them prove that the world always existed. I can do anything. Don't worry about it, he says. There's no end to what I can do. In truth, what caused us not to do this, the reason why we don't do that, and not to believe that the world was always there, are two factors. And then he goes on to his philosophy of why the world has to have been created. The world could not have always existed. His objection is philosophical. His objection is not textual. And that idea is brought to bear on this issue of the age of the universe and the story of Adam and Eve. Yes, it seems like God created them. Yes, it seems like they're the only ones on the scene. But if push comes to shove, I'll explain those verses differently. And I will show you that the verses can actually be read to support the idea of an ancient universe. And that's one school of thought. We're going to come back to this, God willing, next week and talk about this approach, as well as a few others, to the problem of the ancient universe. Thank you very much.